The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Today's first article is entitled Book Publishing Has a Toys R Us Problem by Carter Daugherty and Andrew Park. Earlier this year, the Department of Justice blocked Penguin Random House, owned by the German media giant Bertelsmann, from acquiring Simon & Schuster. The Big Five publishers, HarperCollins, Penguin Random House, Hachette, Macmillan, and Simon & Schuster, already control about 80% of the book market. The literary class was relieved. Less than a year later, the private equity firm Kohlberg Kravitz Roberts announced it would buy Simon & Schuster. Because the firm doesn't already own a competing publisher, the deal is unlikely to trigger another antitrust probe. But KKR, infamous as Wall Street's Barbarians at the Gate since the 1980s, may leave Simon & Schuster employees and authors yearning for a third choice beyond a multinational conglomerate or a powerful financial firm. It may be a stay of execution, but we should all be worried about how things will look at Simon & Schuster in 5 years, says Ellen Adler, the publisher at The New Press, a nonprofit focused on public interest books. On its face, the Simon & Schuster acquisition appears to be a standard private equity deal, which is precisely the problem. Private equity is the anodyne label adopted after leveraged buyouts got a bad name, in part thanks to KKR's ravaging of RJR Nabisco after a $25 billion takeover in 1988. In a leveraged buyout, the buyer takes over a company with a small amount of its own money, a larger amount of investors' money, and a whole lot of debt. KKR agreed to pay $1.62 billion for Simon & Schuster, of which $1 billion will reportedly be borrowed money. From the perspective of the private equity firm, leverage is a feature, not a bug. Purchase a company for $100 million in cash and no debt, make $5 million in profit annually, and it will deliver a return of 5%. Buy the same company using 60% debt, and that same profit in absolute terms yields a 12.5% return. Crucially, Simon & Schuster, not KKR, is responsible for repaying the debt. KKR simply raises it against the publisher's franchise value to fund any acquisition. Lenders have no recourse to KKR or its executives, who are legally shielded from liability. Technically, KKR won't own Simon & Schuster. The owner will be a fund that KKR advises. Moody's will likely assign the $1 billion debt a credit rating about five levels below investment grade, according to Bloomberg, the corporate equivalent of subprime mortgages, based on terms granted to similarly rated borrowers, and on our analysis of the Bloomberg data on recent transactions, Simon & Schuster would have to pay interest rates above 9%. That would cost the publisher nearly $100 million, about 40% of operating income in 2022, on interest alone. In raw financial terms, the transaction will weaken Simon & Schuster the moment it closes, never mind what KKR does as an owner. Both KKR and Simon & Schuster declined to comment for this article. Debt up to these levels is quite simply a stressor on the company, says Eileen Applebaum, a prominent critic of private equity and a co-director of the Center of Economic and Policy Research. It undermines its ability to invest in technology, marketing, workers, and everything else. Private equity executives argue that the debt is worth it. They will have their business savvy to make their new acquisition so much more profitable that they'll be able to sell it in a few years for much more than they paid for it. Where will that extra value come from? KKR is touting plans to expand into new genres of publishing domestically and into overseas markets, among other tactics. But the standard private equity playbook is a mixture of slashing costs and pumping up cash flow. Sometimes this pays off, at least for the private equity firm, because there are workers let go and assets to sell. But the push toward pure short-term profit maximization can get ugly. Although private equity's foray into book publishing is new, funds have been buying up news publications for the past decade. When they do, they tend to lay off reporters and editors, cut back on print editions, and invest less in the resources necessary for great journalism. Alden Global Capital, one of the most infamous, is known for acquiring newspapers and then selling off their buildings to its own real estate flipping subsidiary. In at least one case, that resulted in a major newspaper paying rent to Alden for office space it used to own. But those moves may not apply to book publishing. Simon & Schuster does not own the building at Rockefeller Center that bears its name. It only has about 1,500 employees, and KKR has said that no layoffs are planned. So the new owners might seek other ways to juice short-term returns. Dan Sinikin, a professor at Emory University and the author of the forthcoming Big Fiction, How Conglomeration Changed the Publishing Industry in American Literature, predicts that KKR will double down even more than big publishers already have on proven authors or celebrity memoirs at the expense of riskier unknown writers, an approach akin to Hollywood's love of the sequel. To a cost cutter, established brands substitute for expensive marketing. Book publishers make money from sales of an original product, a portion of which goes to authors in the form of royalties. Perhaps the true pot of gold for private equity in publishing. Although there's nothing wrong with monetizing intellectual property, Simon and Schuster authors should expect intense pressure to give the publisher a bigger slice of that pie. A more speculative possibility involves the use of the author's original work to train AI models that then generate new monetizable content. That scenario could provide KKR's Simon & Schuster with a way to squeeze out money through co-ownership of copyrights, a prospect that alarms authors. If you train an AI model on Daniel Steele's nearly 200 books and write a new one, somebody has to own the rights, Sinikin says. Ultimately, KKR may not even need to solve the riddle of increased profitability. As it is often the case with private equity, it can profit even if Simon & Schuster does not. The $620 million not covered by debt will come from a fund that KKR assembled from a collection of entities including a dozen state pension funds, a Chinese insurer, and a pilots' union in Iceland. Applebaum predicts that the sliver from KKR itself could be 2 to 10%, or $12.4 million to $62 million. KKR put up only 0.06% of its own money in the RJ Nabisco takeover. But the company can start harvesting cash immediately. Private equity firms collect management fees from their investors and monitoring or advisory fees from the companies they purchase. KKR and its partners collected $185 million in advisory fees from Toys R Us before bankrupting it. With Simon & Schuster, fees alone could let KKR make its own money back in a few years. Another technique for extracting money goes by the opaque name dividend recapitalization. A recent headline in the Wall Street Journal described it more transparently, debt-fueled payouts. The acquired company issues a bond to raise money that it then paid out to its new owners and used to refinance old debt. It's a common tactic in private equity. Earlier this year, KKR pulled $750 million, $385 million for itself, out of Atlantic Aviation, which provided services to plane owners. The company now groans under a debt load 7 times its annual earnings, according to Moody's. In their recent book about private equity, These Are the Plunderers, Gretchen Morgenson and Joshua Rosner recount maddening stories about KKR, how it bankrupted Toys R Us, gouged the residents of Bayonne, New Jersey for water and sewage, and very recently ran a vital provider of emergency services into the ground. If KKR's latest deal follows a similar trajectory, Morganson and Rosner might have a harder time documenting it. Their publisher is Simon & Schuster. Next, America could be in for a rough fall, by Lois Parshley. On Labor Day, you could drive from Minnesota's border with Canada all the way to where Louisiana hits the Gulf of Mexico and not encounter a high under 90 degrees. The heat hasn't broken. Today, nearly a third of Americans are sweltering under heat alerts. Such weather is a fitting end to a devastating season, the kind you run out of superlatives for. This summer, climate extremes suddenly seemed to be everywhere, all at once. It was the world's hottest June since humans started keeping track. July was even worse. Phoenix, which averaged 102 degrees in July, got so hot that people received third-degree burns from touching doorknobs. In Iowa, livestock dropped dead in their pens. The disasters weren't limited to heat. Canadian wildfires blanketed large swaths of the United States in smoke. Flash floods thundered through Vermont, and wildfires reduced parts of Maui to rubble. Pumpkin spice is already back on the Starbucks menu, but fall isn't poised to provide a respite. El Niño, the warm phase of a naturally recurring cycle that can wreak havoc on global weather patterns, has officially returned, and it's predicted to be a strong one. The southern U.S. will likely be wetter, while forecasts for a warm winter in the north. These cycles always have some variability, but experts say that the climate crisis has now raised temperatures to the extent that they may also amplify El Niño. This summer has shown starkly how climate change can supercharge the weather. This fall, El Niño could further magnify the problem. Although El Niño's technically started in June, it likely didn't contribute much to this summer's extremes. That was the climate crisis. Across the U.S., hundreds of temperature records fell. Kansas City's heat index approached that of Death Valley. Chicago had to reduce its train speed because high temperatures stressed the tracks. Historically, El Niño events during the summer have very little impact over the United States. Michelle Lajero, a client scientist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, told me. Climate change, however, is having an impact. Scientists once hesitated to say how global warming might worsen weather. Now they can accurately measure just how much climate contributes to events, such as heat waves. An international team of researchers found that climate change made July's heat waves in the U.S., Europe, and China hotter by as much as 2 degrees Celsius or 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit as a result of the climate change. After this summer's extremes, it's daunting to be entering the height of an El Niño cycle. Typically, because of the direction the world spins, winds move from east to west across the tropics. This blows warm surface water away from South America, where colder water swells up to replace it. But every 2 to 7 years, these winds weaken and more warm water remains along the Americas, producing El Niño. When the winds strengthen, you get its counterpart, La Niña. The Pacific Ocean is huge, covering a third of the Earth, so these cycles can cause dramatic variations in global storms and droughts. That's why Lajero calls El Niño the Great Nudger. As she explains, it nudges atmospheric patterns over the globe in certain directions that causes weather patterns to reoccur. Unlike during La Niña, when a cooler ocean can absorb more heat, El Niño basically acts as a temporary boost to global warming, bumping global temperatures up by about a tenth of a degree Celsius, or roughly two-tenths of a degree Fahrenheit. The effects, however, vary by location. Some places become colder, while others become much warmer. A strong El Niño during the winter of 1997-98, for example, caused flooding in California, while Indonesia and Philippines suffered under a severe drought. In 2016, another record El Niño contributed to what is still officially the world's warmest year on record. NOAA estimates it raised the annual global temperature by 0.12 degrees Celsius or 0.2 degrees Fahrenheit above average. The influence of El Niño is also potentially intensifying because of climate change. Warmer air holds more moisture, setting the stage for more extreme precipitation. Likewise, hotter temperatures may worsen the drought conditions it already tends to bring to some locations. El Niño impacts do not work in isolation anymore. There's always a climate component, Lajero said. Unless you're a mosquito in New Mexico, that is not good news for the fall and winter. Right now, satellite sensors and models suggest that ocean temperatures are gradually increasing as the cycle gathers strength. El Niño's impacts will be most visible later in the fall and into winter 2024. It's called El Niño, or Little Boy in Spanish, after the newborn Christ, because the cycle tends to peak around Christmas. At that point, much of the southern U.S. will likely see wetter conditions. Meanwhile, the Pacific Northwest is predicted to be drier, while the northern part of the country may have balmy weather. Because it's a climate forecast, and we can't say anything definitively, we put probabilities on everything, Lajero said. Based on past El Niños, the U.S. may be in for more climate extremes. In 1997 and 98, for example, California saw 150% of its normal rainfall, washing away roads and producing deadly, home-destroying mudslides. The Midwest practically had no winter, with some areas experiencing average temperatures 12 degrees warmer than in a normal year. Some may cheer a milder fall and winter, but that might also heighten the risk of troubling heat deeper into September and October. And warmer temperatures could set the stage for worse wildfires next summer. That's not to mention all the other downstream effects from knocking normal patterns out of whack. In 2016, for example, a cool, wet spring was great for fleas and other disease-carrying insects, increasing cases of plague in West Nile in the southwest. Going back to 1982 and 83, the unseasonable heat in Alaska was likely behind the reduced salmon harvest, while warmer waters caused a rash of shark bites off the Oregon coast. Nor, of course, is El Niño merely a U.S.-specific problem. Just like with climate change, developing countries are often hit the hardest. Pateri Talas, Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization, warned that as a result of El Niño, the coming months may have far-reaching repercussions for health, food security, water management, and the environment. The sum total of heat could cause global temperatures to surge past an infamous benchmark, 1.5 degrees Celsius warmer than the pre-industrial era, topping records set during the last El Niño in 2016. Lajero leads the El Niño's Southern Oscillation team at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, and her team predicts that El Niño has a more than 95% chance of lasting through February 2024. After that, it's hard to say. El Niños typically persist for about a year, but the exact timing and intensity of each cycle may vary. In a warmer future, El Niños may stretch longer. A recent Nature paper suggests there's some evidence that the transitions between El Niño and La Niña phases may be slowing down, which means that the conditions associated with them could stick around. These are complicated systems, and many parts of El Niño's cycle still aren't well understood. But figuring out how these cycles may be changing is important, because climate models rely on our best attempt at describing current conditions in order to make assumptions about how the world might change. If the assumptions aren't accurate, they could alter our forecasts for climate impacts. There's a lot of uncertainty with these models, Lajero said. That's true of how we experience climate change, too. The weather in any given year can have a lot of variability, a point Senator James Inhofe's congressional snowball accidentally made. Climate change may not always feel linear. This past summer, its impacts felt like they fast-forwarded. A hot winter, fueled in part by El Niño, doesn't necessarily mean next summer will be even worse. But in the long term, the trend of higher temperatures is undebatable. Disconcertingly, this is all still just the overture to a world that looks very different from the one we've known to date. Allegra Legrand, a physical research scientist at the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, told me that by the time her young children are in their 40s, they won't have a summer as cool as the summer has been. Though researchers have predicted dire climate consequences for decades, many of the scientists I've spoken with this summer have wrestled with how to feel about the recent drumbeat of broken records. For her part, LeGrand has been coping by binging survival shows like Alone that drop contestants in the wilderness to see how long they can withstand the elements. A cinematic version of the shifting reality many are already starting to face off screen. No matter how much you study or read the climate crisis, it hits differently when you have to confront it every time you walk outside. After this summer's strangeness, the science may be complicated, but the conclusion is simple. Even when this El Niño dissipates and the world returns to a cooler phase, it won't be enough to counteract the march toward a hothouse Earth. Only we can do that. From the Books Department, Why Would Anyone Become a Politician? By Michael Ignatieff. Why would anyone want to be a politician? The pay isn't great if you stay honest. The hours are long, the media attention you face can be brutal. Your chances of getting anything done are slight unless you get to the very top. I should know. I was a politician in my native Canada for 6 years, and I have the scars to prove it. Although Americans think we are a kinder, gentler version of them, the fact is that our politics is just as nasty and partisan, and after our Parliament Hill was occupied for 3 weeks by disgruntled truckers, sometimes just as wildly unpredictable. Social media has made it worse. When I used to meet constituents in the flesh, they were civil even if they weren't ever going to vote for me. But digital disinhibition turned people into vipers. What some of my fellow citizens thought fit to say to me, about me, and my opponents too, doesn't bear repeating. And women have it much worse. Sigrid Kaag recently resigned as the leader of a Dutch Liberal Party, citing the hate, intimidation, and threats. So truly, why does anyone bother? A new memoir by Rory Stewart, How Not to Be a Politician, confirms why politics is a terrible way to live, but also why it continually lures ambitious people into the game. Stewart has written an unsparing and brilliant portrait of his decade as a lawmaker, culminating in his failed bid to become prime minister. The lying, incompetence, and treachery he depicts are all so blatant that the book should be assigned to bright young things to rid them of any remaining illusions before they put their name on a ballot. But if Stewart has such a dim view of the whole enterprise, how can we understand why this gifted writer, with a varied and unusual background, would choose to become a backbench member of Parliament for Penrith, a beautiful but remote constituency in the north of England? In Stewart's case, the unusual mix of cliched reasons applied. The desire to make a difference, do something that really matters, be part of history, serve the people, and, yes, get your name in lights. Fame certainly spurred him on, but for me and for Stewart, I'm sure, something deeper than celebrity was at play. The belief that political success would give your life greater meaning and establish you, among those you respect, as a serious person. To all of this should be added the important fact that Stewart's father was a courageous military officer, a distinguished member of the British Secret Service, and obviously an inspiration to his son. You shouldn't go into politics just to prove yourself. Skydiving would be an easier path. One reason alone really justifies the effort and all those slings and arrows: to get power and to do something with it. Stewart did get power. He was a minister for the environment, international development, foreign affairs, and prisons in a ministerial career that lasted a scant 5 years. The portfolio range is staggering, and in each case he did his best to achieve something. But even when he was able to get his hands on the levers, it was often only to discover that getting things done was astonishingly difficult. Sometimes the obstacle was a fellow politician who would intrigue against him. Sometimes it was a civil servant in his own department who would tell him, with a straight face, that what Stewart wanted to achieve was above his pay grade. Sometimes it was, as when he was in charge of Britain's international aid program, uncovering that, with all kinds of good intentions, what aid programs from his country were doing was essentially shoveling money into bottomless pits all over the world. All of this led to discouraging awareness as he sat in splendid high-ceilinged offices created when Britain was a world power, that the junior minister in a mid-sized post-imperial power that had just left the European Union, he could try to exercise his country's influence globally, and nothing much would happen beyond a photo op. Calling your memoir How Not to Be a Politician suggests that Stuart does not intend this to be an initiation narrative in which our hero passes through painful stages from innocence to experience. Rather, the book often reads like a discovery narrative, the hero's dawning realization that the game was not worth the effort, that he had been duped by his own ambitions to play at something that wasn't a match for his talents. Stuart was quick to pick up that he was an outsider to the party establishment. His years as a writer, during which he trekked across Afghanistan, set up a charity there, and established himself as a critic of international aid and development policy, marked him as not one of us. David Cameron, the super posh prime minister when Stuart entered Parliament, ought to have seen his qualities and rewarded him with more responsibility. Instead, as Stuart describes it, the one old Etonian froze the other one out. All of this may seem of interest only to those who are fascinated by the archaic and arcane world of the British class system, but Stuart's difficulties in elevating himself inside the Conservative Party illustrate the larger truth about politics everywhere. Tribalism abounds, along with customs only those lifers really understand. The three abiding rules are as follows. You must be loyal, you must wait your turn, and winning is everything. Stuart was too intelligent to be loyal, to shut up and bite his tongue. He was too impatient to respect the order of seniority that kept him off the key committee assignments in the House of Commons, though he did secure a place in the Foreign Affairs Committee, and its persistence eventually won him promotion to a cabinet post. Stuart's time in office is a cautionary tale about the price of a politician can pay when he tries to tell the truth. Brexit, Britain's referendum decision to exit the European Union in 2016, is turning out to be a multifaceted disaster, and Stuart, who campaigned to remain in the EU, was one of those who tried to get his party and his country to understand what a mistake they had made and then figure out how, realistically, to make the best of a bad situation. He lost the race for leader, fundamentally because he told his party what it did not want to hear. Once Johnson won the prime ministership, he threw Stuart and other like-minded MPs out of the party and went on to win the next election decisively, with assurances that Stuart continued to insist were a pack of lies. I'm sorry that I've cut that book review a little short because we've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, and have a great day.